episode of Threads of Enlightenment, guys. We were having fun even before we got on here. But, you know, my custom is to welcome our guests. I know they're coming with a couple of things I deem very expensive, their time. Time is one of the most precious commodity afforded to the human being while we're here on this planet Earth. 24 hours. One of us have 24 hours. What we do with that 24 hours per day will speak volumes of you. You have to learn to respect, honor, and just fall in love with time, just like anything else. And she will hug you and reward you. The other is the journey. The journey is power. Why? It has creation power because it created the individual before us. And so we want to thank Andrea for coming and sharing these precious commodity with us. And for from the bottom of our heart, because we know that she's already beginning to spend some expensive stuff. And thank you for coming with us here at Threads of Enlightenment.
Oh, thank you, Ken. I don't want to give you the pat. Oh, I'm so excited to be here. We were joking right before we hit record. I said, just talking to you, I feel so calm and so at peace. And so I'm eager to share what I have and to do that with evidently a community that likes to have that same kind of energy as well. So thank you. It's my privilege to be here.
Honor to have you. One of the things that we like talking about here, that I always tell people, how do you serve? And I mentioned that to you on the onset. I asked that because I want the audience to come along with us and become servants. There's nothing like it. So we want to invite them to become a servant. But that means you got to go through your journey. So how do you serve mankind, Andrea?
My official service statement is that I help other women, especially women leaders, change the culture that they're in, that sounds like, oh, that sounds lovely, but it's not easy. It's quite hard by trusting themselves to think critically. And I find that that's one of the biggest things that we as women, especially in the Western world, have is this challenge of being willing to trust the way we think, trust our minds, trust our wisdom. But once we can learn to think critically, then we have the ability to create with great imagination. So I say I like to help women think critically, create imaginatively. And with all of that, when we are who we are, that's what makes us an impactful leader, and then we lead others effectively. I think the timing is right for this, but at the same time, I don't teach anything that I haven't experienced. One of my top core values is authenticity. Therefore, I am going to only teach you what I know. We talk, you know, you and I were talking a little bit about the journey, and I love that you said that's a commodity that we have. That is something that has taught me much. Even this morning, more things learning, writing in my journal, saying, oh, look at that. That's a fear I haven't let go of. That's a hurdle I've put in front of myself. So
I think the journey will never end until we leave this realm. Who knows the new set of journey that awaits us from that space as well. But this is, we are here at this time for this journey. And one of the things that we love to celebrate and is the first space that we visit for a little while. I tell people life is about a series of spaces and a series of internal decisions that we make within the subconscious mind, which will propel us. One of the first space that we visit is called the family. We love to start there because there, I believe, this happened to us. And we make these wonderful little internal decisions as children, things that happen to us as a family. What was your family like?
I am a Southern Baptist preacher's kid and missionary.
Oh, PK kids, you know what they say about you guys. You guys are just,
They're all bad, right.
I started as a PK,
but then became an MK, a missionary kid. I was born while my dad and my mother and my dad were basically engaged in 10th grade. And I mean, they were just high school sweethearts and got married. And I was born while they were still in college. And then my sister was born while my dad was in seminary. And we moved a lot. I think I counted before I got married, I moved 17 times. And so there's a little instability built into that. So the family unit becomes extremely strong and extremely important. Like this is it, right? I have nobody else to lean on. But then going onto the mission field, it became this community of other expatriates, other missionaries. And so I have an extended group of aunts and uncles that my husband, when he first met me, he's like, wait, whose brother and sister is that? I'm like, no, these missionary aunts and uncles. And so there was this community that I had while in Korea. I grew up in Seoul, and we would go down to the beach on the, it's Daechan, which is, I think of the Bumsango something. It's down on the West Coast. And the missionary community rented that from the Korean government for 99 years. And we had little cabins, and it was this little oasis, a little bit like an Adirondack lake area, you know, with cabins, and we had tennis courts and a lodge, and we had all kinds of stuff. But at the same time, my family unit was still the most important. My mom was extremely effusive and outgoing and happy. My dad is very practical and very, you know, rule following. And I am the one that is, I very much want to think for myself, and it did not go well. From day one, I was called the strong-willed child. I always had my own drummer that I wanted to march to, and that was just not acceptable. But, you know, our parents do what they can with what they have. My sister came along nearly 5 years later. Again, she was perfect. She and my mother had similar personalities. This is, of course, being tongue-in-cheek, right, looking back. Yeah. I have been through years and years and years of therapy and counseling. And just, as you said, you know, being an investigator of my own self, I never stop. But my sister just didn't have that problem with my folks. She was like my mother. I ended up leaving school. I'm leaving home and going to college in Texas. And then they came home from Korea to the States. And I moved home after college, really just not sure what I wanted to do. And my sister said, let me give you a tip. When mom and dad say, do this or don't do that, just say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. She said, you can then go do whatever you want. But why do you argue with them? This is like a brick wall. And I'm like,
yeah,
very honest.
It's different.
The family unit was very steeped in a patriarchal understanding of how things would work. My mother was an extremely strong woman and found a way to be the strong woman behind the man. Yeah. And I'm not saying it was, there was no malintent there. That's what they were taught. You know? So I grew up in that very strong evangelical patriarchal family unit. And yet, in Korea, going to school with kids from 65 different countries, seeing different cultures, hearing different languages, all of that. It was a little bit confusing sometimes, looking back, I think, for me to be able to say, which group do I belong to? How does this work? Is it okay to be ecumenical? Is it not okay? So there was a lot of confusion for me as I grew up.
Fascinating, because you have your religious belief system, that mom, and then you have Korea with all these nationalities and so forth. To have your strong will in the mix of that is a recipe for some personal development. We talk later. Some stuff got buried in there. And
when
moving
you're young,
around.
You run away. Yeah, when you're young, you build up. I built a lot of walls. I tapped into the rules to say, if I can just do the rules better. Yeah. I became, you know, the strongest one in certain areas, just because I needed to prove that I was okay to me and to everybody else. And that can be, that's a recipe for disaster and a recipe for, hey, you need some personal growth.
Well, I'm sure later on in life, you had to uncover some of those things, and you're still uncovering some of those things that took place there. Because I always tell people, that's the area that we start to make decisions, internal decisions, that will become a force or a compass that will guide us through our life for many years until it begins to damage us. And it's amazing how something very benign as young kids and other things moving that has to do a lot with security. And all of those things, you have the subconscious things that will be there, but then you have those underlying things that are not spoken of but felt and is able to part of your being without you even knowing it. Talking about training the subconscious individual that is you. So here you are, this young girl, in the mix of all of that, your independence, your strength. And you said that you were privy to some nice conversation with mom and dad that helped you grow up a little faster in this household. And I do understand the Christian household and their belief system. And the question that I can come up with is, as this young girl is in this mix, confusion and all of that, tell me about her. Call that memory our time machine that we go back. Tell me about this girl. There's still so much richness of culture, all of these other things that she's getting experienced and well, and all the other things. How are we doing? How is she doing?
I hate to say not great. I think there are ways that I look back sometimes some of the learning and the deprogramming I had to do was not necessarily my family. It was me just trying to protect myself because the richness of the culture, the beauty of the differences, even the Korean culture versus our Western culture, I found it all fascinating. I find there are many things I find about it that are so appealing, the way that the culture treats the elderly, the way the culture treats the poor, the way they even just revere their ancestors. And that is very contrary to much Western Christian belief and even Western stuff. And I was taught, you know, as like I said, my parents did the best they could with what they had. Yeah. And I was taught that I was an American and I was always going to go back to America and that was my home. And so because I was confused and because, you know, Ken, when we have what we call cognitive dissonance, when things look one way, but we think they're another, and there's this constant battle, this constant rubbing and kind of inflammation, if you will, in our hearts or in our minds, we find a way to soothe that. We find a way to put a Band-Aid on that unless we know what to do with it. And when I was young, I didn't know what to do with it. Yeah. And I developed bulimia at a very early age because that was one thing I could control. You know, you mentioned, I mentioned moving 17 different times, and there wasn't much I could control. I am very outgoing in a certain sense, but I'm very much an introvert. And so I had a hard time because my family genetically is a little overweight. I had a hard time fitting in back in the 70s and 80s. There weren't many chubby people internationally. Yeah. And so I really struggled. And I think I was afraid of becoming anorexic. And so I just kind of went the other way. And, I think I knew deep down that I was a leader, and I knew also that that was not accepted in my culture. I knew that I was somebody who could make a difference in other people's lives, but that just was not accepted in my culture. At least I just didn't see the way that I was designed as somebody that could fit into my culture or into my demographic. And, so I was constantly looking for ways to be different than what I was created to be. And I was not the rebellious kid. I was the one who followed all the rules. I didn't go to the parties. I didn't, you know, I was looking for the way to be the perfect child. Yeah. And that is another reaction that a lot of us have. And it didn't work out great.
No such thing as perfection, as I say. In my studies and everything that I've ever read and all that stuff, the closest thing that came to a perfection with this was this guy that they hung on a cross.
I'm not Jesus.
So we don't appreciate perfection, if you will, even though we chase it. So here you are, this girl is moving in, and you were told, and within your programming, that Korea is not your home, America is your home. So you going through school and so forth, and you mentioned earlier that you left before them. When you were putting those plans together as a family, was Andrea doing, knowing that she is leaving, as she stated earlier, the security blanket with being the family got closer. Now she's beginning to go on her own, create her own world into this place that was told to her that that's where she belongs. Was those conversation and the day you left, how did you feel?
Oh, you made me cry. You're going to pull up some tears there, buddy. You know, when you are going away 10,000 miles away from your family, my mother went with me.
Yeah.
And to drop me off at school, I did not have a car. I was going to Houston, Texas, 90 miles from my grandparents there in Southeast Texas. They were all four alive at the time. And we didn't have a lot. I had a full ride scholarship at Houston Baptist University. There is, looking back, I wish someone could have talked me into staying at home and doing like basically community college for a couple of years. Yeah. I was 17. I did not have the maturity to do this. And I already had a flawed sense of self, a flawed sense of understanding how I belonged. And just, it was a traumatic experience, but it was one of those that you could not have talked me out of it. I just couldn't. I knew deep down that I needed to fly on my own and that I needed to be out of the house and that I needed to find who I was. And the only unfortunate thing was I didn't really know how to do it. So I walked in and said, well, I need to be in a sorority because that's how you belong. And I need to be, you know, I need to find a church and join a church because that's how you belong, right? I left this community, even though it was my small family and then this community, and I went and looked for other places to belong. And the community that I had was built over like 10 years and we grew up together and it was unique. And so I did not fare well my freshman and sophomore years of college. Even joining a sorority, I made sure I joined the good girl sorority. You know, we didn't drink. We didn't know where those guys who did. But my weight skyrocketed. My depression skyrocketed. By the time I was a sophomore in college, I was counting the days that I could miss class. I was a straight A student. You know, but counting the days I could miss class and just sitting in my apartment with the windows drawn, the curtains drawn, eating gallons of Bluebell ice cream, just to comfort myself somehow. But leaving home, looking back at it, it was, my dad doesn't cry much. He's one of those stoic people. And he cried. And it was just like, what is that? I mean, my dad cried. This is terrible. But even my mom, when she left, she dropped me off because they weren't finished doing the dorms. Pardon me if this is not okay. Let me know and we'll stop.
Oh, this is all okay.
I am a transparent person, so it doesn't bother
this
me.
This is all okay, Andrew. All
my
okay.
mom dropped me off in, we were staying in a hotel because they weren't done with renovating our dorms. And she dropped me off and she had found a car for me. And when she went to go to the airport to leave, I pretended that I wasn't going to say goodbye. And then I found myself like a movie running out in the parking lot in a flannel gown in Houston, Texas. Stop! And I can't help but fast forward to when we lost her in 2017, in February 2017, to breast cancer. Every time I visited, it's one of the reasons we moved down to Charlottesville was to be closer to them because they were in Richmond. Mm. And every time we visited, she would say, have I told you everything? Have I apologized for everything? Is there anything you need to hear from me? So she was this beautiful example of, she wasn't perfect. She wasn't perfect when she died. But looking back at the relationship we had, it was constantly because I was so different. Yeah. And yet she's in her own way still wanted to celebrate that. So leaving home for me was like being ripped. Yeah. It was just being ripped apart. It was like the tapestry, because you talk about we're designers, and I like to talk about how everything we do is, and every person we meet is a thread in the tapestry. And it was like my tapestry was being ripped. And I didn't quite know how to put those threads back together.
Yeah.
And the reality is, it wasn't being ripped. It's just what it felt like. Yeah. So when you develop that kind of really insular understanding of your family, when you move and when you leave and when you do that, that was the first step to me saying, I'm not going to be like my family. I'm going to be a little different and I have to be me. And I didn't start off well. I did not know how to do it. But it was my first fledgling step at 17.
I think anyone knows how to do it.
But here you are, and I still don't know how to do it.
That's a powerful story, Andrew, of a 17-year-old girl who is now beginning a journey. She has relinquished her family. She's now on her own. And she's stepping into her creation in her mind. Went to get her the church. She went to get her things and doing to try and bring those things that were familiar to her that family unit together so that she can be. She's done that. She's sad. She's depressed. She's there. And was it because the depression is one of the excuses that can be a dark time in one life, one period that we move as we navigate people. Again, life is spaces that we visit for a period based on some eternal internal decision that we make. We have to escort ourselves. Survival mode as a child, because that's what we do. We take the trauma, we turn it in, and we become survivors. We live as survivors until it begins to explode and implode and all the plodes that happens. She is this girl.
Yes.
To us right there, because that is a powerful place to be for a young woman. How did she manage that space?
I'm going to be honest and say just not well. I had some people who loved me and intervened. And leaving my dad at Kimpo Airport in Incheon, Korea, in I guess June or July of 1984, was traumatic. And then I went back for the summer after my freshman year. But then it was bad enough in my sophomore year that my grandparents actually called my dad, and this was, missionaries don't make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And the next thing I know, spring semester of my sophomore year, my dad called me from Korea and said, I'm going to be at the airport on this day at this time, and you're going to come get me. And he's the one who came home to check on me, to make sure I was getting what I needed, and kind of helped me move through. It was like an intervention, you know. It was like, you can't do this. This is not okay.
Yeah.
But it was not an accusatory. It was, I'm worried. We're worried about you. And to have people in your life, this is going back to that core unit, to have people in your life who are willing to say, I'm worried about you. And my sister did that for me later on through another thing, another space that I was in. And knowing that we have people like that in our lives is where the real security comes from.
Yeah.
That's where the real, you know, at the time it felt like I was being punished.
Always.
I had racked up some debt and I had a dog that I wasn't caring for. And I mean, it was just, you name it, all these things. And I almost lost my car and, I mean, just all kinds of things. But at the same time, it was, we really do care about you and we want to make sure you're okay. And I'm willing to risk the money and the time, and I'm willing to come back and check on you. And I think that was the piece that woke me up to help me see I need some help. And I went looking for it. I mean, at that moment, it's like I went looking for help. I found an inpatient program. It was 12 weeks and it was the very first, I actually turned 20 in the hospital, and it was the very first time I had ever had anybody say, what do you mean it's not okay to be you? What do you mean it's not? I mean, it's like, these are the things, Andrea, that you, this is how you're designed.
Yeah.
This is how you've been put together. And at the time I still couldn't hear this. And even at 50, I couldn't hear this, but if they don't love you for who you are, they don't love you. Mm-hmm. Being honest with my family through some of that was very difficult because I had to present to them that I had kind of worn a mask most of my life. And what's funny is that come to find out, you look back now and they're like, they could see through your mask, you dork. I mean, it's just like, they knew you were wearing a mask, Andrea, but that young woman needed to protect herself so desperately. I don't even know how to explain that's desperate is a good word. It's a desperation that comes from just really not knowing what to do and really not knowing how to be yourself. And that was kind of where it really all started.
That's a beautiful story. And even in its pain and its rawness, it is a beauty there that the listeners and I, Andrew's opening to us and allowing us to see the power at work in our life. We label that power the journey. She's allowing us some insights as she's going in and exposing herself to us so that we can understand her genesis, where it came from, her birth process that she went through. And if you maybe they're depressed because of, and in that dark room, not because of weight or whatever it is. And we'd like to do a small intervention and to remind you that you are beautiful. It looks dark to you, and I know you don't think you are. I want to say to you that you truly are beautiful as you are right there in your pain, your mess. You are beautiful. You are what you need in order to begin the walk. I need you to listen to what Andrew said. Someone came in, made her aware of her situation. When she saw, made an internal decision. Keep telling you guys, it's so important that internal decision will always propel you into action. Mm-hmm. She began to hunt to find help. And you need to decide, because I say we live circularly because we haven't made a decision yet, that internal decision. Thinking about making a decision, you haven't made it yet. And you make it in your internal being, your soul, that part of you, permission to say, need help. And that part of you will begin to move you through so that you can find it. You went, you recognized the need. Mm. Now you're about to build your team. Everyone needs a team. You got to find your tribe. Now, finding and creating your tribe, when you sought the help, sat down, gonna have to talk. How did that begin to unfold? Those words that you began to say when that person walked in, as you're back in that time machine again, and you're looking at this young girl sitting there. Did she, was her language like as she talked about her situation, number one, and how she talked about herself?
Well, one of the first things that young girl did was she quit trying to be the good girl. But that was a little, that was toward the end. At the very beginning, the mask was still on and they could see it, and they knew, and it, you know, it just, it is a very difficult thing to take the mask off. Yeah. And one of the ways, so my parents were back in the States at the time, they were on furlough. And one of the things that we did was we had individual counseling, we had eating plans, we had exercise plans. We had, I learned meditation for the first time. Yeah. I learned the beauty of sitting still. I learned the beauty of gentle eating. And, but we also had group family therapy, mm-hmm. which for so many evangelical Christians is not appealing at all. And it was a shock to my parents' system, even just letting my family know that I felt like my dad was an absentee father, because in Korea in the 70s and 80s, there was a good number of volatile things that happened when the North Koreans would come. They would dig tunnels under, and they still do a little bit, but not as much as they used to. And then they would discover a tunnel dug by North Koreans. And we lived in Seoul, which is not far from the DMZ. Yeah. They one time came across and took hatchets to all the people in the military, American military in the DMZ. There was an assassination attempt that killed his wife, all these things. My dad was gone maybe 3 to 8 days a month down country. Mm-hmm. He was an event. He helped churches do event, you know, revivals and yeah. that kind of stuff. But he was always gone when those things happened. Yeah. We also lived on a mountain where, because we were in the city of Seoul, they very much protected the presidential home. And there was a gun turret up there, and that would shoot at anything that would come through, and you could see the tracer bullets, and we would hide in our home, you know, in the wow. interior portion of our home. And my sister, who was 5 years younger than me, says, none of that feels traumatic to me because I just grew up with it. And I'm like, yeah, one of these wow. days you're going to recognize the trauma, but that's okay. But when I told in family therapy, I said, and she and I talked about this recently, I said, I feel like you were never there. And my dad's like, what? I was there way more than I would have been if we had been home in the States and I was a pastor. Yeah. Technically, he was correct. But there wasn't this ability for them to see my perspective. And my sister didn't see him as absentee at all, but she was a very independent person, very much like my mom. And that's not who I was. So, yeah. But one of the biggest exercises they gave me was, they said, you're wearing a mask all the time. I need you to not wear makeup for this week. And I'm like, but my mom's coming. She's like, I know. All right. Well, you're going to have to talk to her then because she's going to be upset. And so I just fresh faced it all week. I mean, I'm 20, right? It's night. You can't look that bad. And so my mom shows up and she looks at me and she goes, you look different. I'm like, well, I'm not wearing any makeup. She goes, well, I know you're not wearing any makeup. You look different. You look more at peace, right? So my husband and I still can look back all the way to when he and I met, you know, when he met her. She had a curiosity that was, she was the one who, my dad was the one who was willing to make the interventions, but my mother was the one who was willing to constantly give that little chipping away at the end, small inroads into like, who are you really? You're my firstborn. I love you. I want to have this relationship. We went through some rough patches there with family therapy. She did not want to air dirty laundry. For me to tell her, I don't think you ever really knew me, was extremely offensive. I mean, I was her oldest. So there was a lot of really rough stuff that we went through, but it was that, I don't know, seminal moment, crucible moment, a linchpin, and like to turn, to pivot for my entire family. It was like, I am now going to thrust my family down a different road of we're not going to not talk about these things. We're not going to pretend that everything's okay. We're not, because being in ministry is hard. I'm married a pastor, you know, it's just like, you'd think I would have learned better. But it's hard. And if you're not willing to tackle some of these things, if you're not willing to say, I want my life to be on a different path. And if you know anything about family dynamic therapy, it's almost like we're all on a stage and we all have a part to play. And when one person drops their line, everybody else looks at you and is like, what's going on? You know, alcoholics see this when they decide to get sober, and these are the roles we've been playing. Who do you think you are messing them up? You know, and we went through some of that, but, and it wasn't always easy, but that was the moment when I decided I needed to be courageous and I needed to just do my own thing.
No value is easy. In itself is not easy. I don't care anyone, just life is not an easy thing. But there's aspects of life that one, when we become awake, as they say, that you can become more of a designer of life than just a default member of life where you accept everything. There's this girl, she's gaining her independence. She's having her family see them as, and you begin to strip away the facade, if you will, the mask, as you said. As you begin to clear that out, my dad begins to see aspects of themselves within your relationship. Now are gaining insight into you. One of the greatest tools that you mentioned known to mankind was introduced to you at this point in your life, meditation. Meditation, I tell people, is a powerful tool that allows one to sit quietly and allow your thoughts to slow down. Thought field is running a million miles a minute. In a meditation, I had learned to slow it down, and I began to choose how I want my life. You said one of the things that, for people struggling with weight, one of the things in meditation that they teach is meditative eating, meaning chew your food, slow down and chew your food in a meditative state. You'll see what will happen to you in 2 months as far as eating and how what habits change. Powerful stuff. So here you are, you got introduced to the tool. You utilize that tool at that time, which most of us don't, but you may be a little different.
You know, I'm sitting here telling the story. I'm like, wow, I wish I could say that from that point on, it was all great.
It's never that way, isn't it?
Never that way.
You guys are getting all this stuff out. You're cleaning house, if you will. You're introduced to the tool, and life continues. Where were you going after you sought all the help in your mind, Andrew? Where were you going to? What was that destination that was pulling you that we call independent?
I was going to be in the Christian music industry. And yeah, well, yeah, I mean, we look back on it now, I call it the evangelical industrial complex now. But but at the time, you know, this was the late 80s. And I had been a nursing major because it was super, I mean, I'm good at it. I mean, I probably would have made a great nurse. And it's, yeah. I mean, now you cannot get enough nurses. My dad looked down the road and said, there's always going to be a shortage of nurses. It's a great place to be. And I excelled in the sciences. I excel in empathy. People talk to me. I'm very welcoming. And so I probably would have made a great nurse, but that was part of, I ended my time at Houston Baptist University with the, I dropped out of my pre-nursing course and turned in my stethoscope and all that kind of stuff. And I said, you know, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do it. And it's not, that's not my dream. I wanted to be somehow involved in musical entertainment, preferably in Christian music, because at the time that's what I had bought into. And so I got business courses and I went to Belmont University in Nashville, where I got a business administration degree with a concentration in music industry, studying under and working for kind of the guy who started it all, Bob Malloy. And I went to school with people that you hear on the radio today, that you run record companies today, my roommate. Yeah, I mean, it's just like I touched all the right people and I was in all the right places. And I realized, oh, this was just a rebound. This is like a 180 from where I was headed. And that's not it either. Graduating and living in Los Angeles for a year and then in Nashville for another, because I graduated in Nashville, went back to work for another record company, and realized this is not it. Wow. And so when you're consistently seeking, then it kind of, that should be a red flag. When you feel like you're consistently seeking for something else, that should tell you there's something else that you need to be looking for. And if you don't even know what it is, well, then it's a good time to take a step back. And so I did. I quit my job and I moved back. And my parents said, you know, you can always come home. And I'm like, "That I didn't know that was an option." And by this time, they were in Richmond. My dad went to work for the International Mission Board and they had come off the field. And so I went home to kind of find myself. And I had kind of been toying around with this idea of ministry of some sort. The Christian music industry was going to be it. Filled out my application for graduate school for seminary. And my dad was like, ever the practical person, said, you know, the little old ladies that give money pay basically for your seminary degree. You need to know why you're going and how you're going to use it and how you're going to pay them back. And I'm like, okay. And so it sat for another year and a half, but that's okay. I mean, in a way, I wasn't ready to go at that moment. And I had some other things to go through and to discover about myself and to build in myself. But all I had to do when I was ready was pull that application out and finish writing my paragraph or my reason for going, and was accepted and went in January of 94 to Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth. And I wasn't really sure where that was going to take me. I thought maybe missions or something. Evidently, it's into pastoral ministry with my husband for almost 30 years. And there are times I look back and think, wow, I really wish I had stayed in the music industry. I would have had so much more money. I could have traveled. I talked to one of my best friends from college who's like a COO of one of the big, you've heard of this record company. And, you know, it just, but my heart is more subtle. Yeah. It's not like there's not been trauma. It's not like there's not been hard things. There've been other spaces to walk through, including infertility and adoption and church splits and deconstruction and all of that. But looking at where that girl was at that moment, she was kind of looking for the opposite direction in the safest way possible.
The journey is that space where we are, where we feel uncomfortable. It's there because we haven't arrived in our ground that we need to be there yet. So you're talking, Andrew, to, I pastored a church for many years. So I'm listening to you and I'm like, don't tell her yet.
I can't imagine you would miss it. I mean, and you know what? When you are doing what you are designed to do, we can call it a calling. We can call it a design. When you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you will find joy. You will find fulfillment. You will have the impact you want or that you're designed to have. Mm-hmm. But when you're not, you will always find conflict of some sort. And now, I don't mean that to say that if somebody listening is a pastor of a church and finds it hard, I'm not saying that just because it's hard, that doesn't mean that's where you're not supposed to be there. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. I think the way we measure sometimes hard and easy or good and bad are not reality. They are sometimes circumstantial pieces of our journey that we need to go through. And, you know, I don't know how much longer my husband will pastor this church, but I want to be able to, I want to give him the option of retiring when he's ready. I mean, I'm 57, he's 55, you know, and I'd like to do other things. I think when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you know it.
There's a difference between work, professions, and all this stuff, and your assignment. It has an assignment that is assigned to them before they came here. As I said, as I came from a Christian background, he says, God knew us before we were in the womb by name. So I knew what my mom and dad would call me before they called me. Back then, before all the stuff was put into place and he created time when he created the universe, he had an assignment. He had an assignment for us. When we were born, assignment must be completed or should be completed. And I would use Jesus and everyone in the Bible. We see the Bible tells that Jesus had an assignment. And I tell him, he went, he found Isaiah 61, read his assignment, then he shut the book, and then he began to do what he was assigned to do.
I just taught that lesson Sunday in Sunday school.
So the Holy Spirit, Jesus, Jesus said, I'm leaving, someone else coming, and he has an assignment. The Holy Spirit has an assignment. He will show you and lead you and guide you in all truth and show you things to come. He is your comforter. So he has an assignment that separate the Holy Spirit, separate unto me Paul and Barnabas, because I have an assignment for them. And so every one of us have an assignment. It's not a job. You start jobbing, you are going to miss your assignment. And I think because many of us are jobbing, maybe some of the pastors are jobbing.
You
know, well, I've met them.
My favorite to quote is that I'm his handiwork. I am his masterpiece, created in Jesus to do good stuff, which he prepared for me in advance to do.
Before the foundation of the earth.
A lot of people don't like the Apostle Paul, but I find him to be this lovely brainiac that figured things out. But I agree. A lot of times we are jobbing, and this is where I think it comes, the conversation could potentially go to however you want to do it, but to this idea of conditioning, we are conditioned to think that certain things must be done, that we do certain things in a certain way. When someone gets a degree in theology and goes to be a pastor or in ministry all their life, or a degree in law and goes to be a lawyer, or a degree in business and goes to be in business, that can't be it. There has to be more. And I think that that's the piece that I love helping people figure out is what is it you are uniquely designed to do and to be? And in order to do that, you have to learn to be able to think critically. You have to look at the assumptions you have and the beliefs that you carry. Where did they come from? Why are they getting in your way? And the conditioning that we have. I mean, this is when I start getting all hyped up.
How they designed us. They tell us that we ought to be this way. You have to go and study this to do this and do that. That's the condition. Then you get the white picket fence, you get married, you have the 2.6 kids. All of that stuff. That's the programming. But again, as I said, if you are doing the jobbing, that's where you're going to stay. If you are going to pursue your assignment, things begin to, you have to know who you are first.
Yes.
You have to learn a couple of things about you. You have to learn about who is giving you the assignment. What is the assignment about? Some things you'll get to know, but then there is the greater aspect of one's assignment where you don't know anything, and we're all called to walk by faith. I don't care where you, you know, and that's just how it's set up. And so the programming is what God has to deal with. Then to unprogram us by renewing our mind, because we have to learn a new principles, and I tell people, I try to explain salvation in this fashion. I was born in a programmed world, and we were taught certain things about ourselves. When we want to switch into another kingdom, to enter the other kingdom the same way we came in this kingdom, one must be born again. And that's just that born again gives us that we had a connection that was severed when through disobedience, and it will be reconnected by obedience. We got a new spirit, and that soul of us is still corrupted, because the Bible says, I your word in my soul that I may not sin against you. That guy right there, in there, the soul, is the one that God is working on. He has to reprogram him now to new policies and procedures that are in this particular kingdom. We have a tendency of reverting back to the old policies and procedures, and that's when we have the conflict within ourselves, because we are in a new kingdom. I'm in it, but I'm not of that old one. So I have to learn new policies and procedures. And that's the problem that we are having with that oscillation in our walk, is we keep applying the old policies in the new kingdom don't work that way. So it's designed differently, but that's a different topic. But here you are, and there you're moving. You are called to go and begin to study, and God separated you for a while so that he can talk to you, to then begin to steer you, because that uneasiness was there because you were not in the right park, as I said. So as you stepped into this right park, and you began to work on you, because you can't go in there and learn just the brain stuff and God not work on you. You got to know who you are. The list to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy mind, and then to love your neighbor as you love yourself. He's going to start teaching you some stuff about you. You are learning about you and strengthening that relationship, that conduit, is, if you will. Did you start to notice about Andrea as she is in this new space that she has walked into, feel the pull to, was happening with her when she got there?
I think one of the things I noticed is that I have a real desire to think for myself and to not be told what to do. And I think that's what at three was called a strong-willed child. I love being able to process things and to listen and to take it in and to decide for myself. And I have a little bit of a counter, if we're talking Enneagram language, a little bit of a counterphobic six going on here, where I, you know, when Michael Jackson was popular, I was not a Michael Jackson fan. When Boston was popular, I was not a Boston fan. You know, it's just like whatever the big popular thing is, that's not me. And so what I have found as I'm walking in a totally different new direction, and it doesn't look all that different to people on the outside, but on the inside, it's a very courageous walk, because I'm no longer listening for other people's validation. No, I'm teaching myself not to listen for other people's validation, and I'm teaching myself to look for literally, what do I see that is true? What do I see that is good? What do I see that is beautiful? And doing that is a very different process. Looking for, I talked a while back about belonging, understanding that belonging can come with just me. I don't have to have other people. I have my own family now. I have my husband and my son, and there's a belonging there. But the rest of my nuclear family, especially, I mentioned my sister reached out in a moment or a space that I was in, and made it very clear that we're not going to agree on a lot of things, and that's okay, and that we're going to belong. And just reestablishing some of those things that when I was a child, there were things that were really beautiful about my existence. And that strong core family was not a bad thing, but relying on that as my only source of stability and safety, that's where it went wrong. And being able to say now, oh, I have that now. I get to just be me. The best thing that I have to offer anybody else is being who I was designed to be. And that's been the biggest game changer for me in my work and my walk and my growth. The
Bible says one of my favorite scriptures is, come, let's reason together.
Yeah.
Love that, because I am bringing everything with me, because the invitation says, let's reason. That means we are going to, you're not going to agree on something. That's why we are reasoning. I should invite some people to some of our conversation that I have with my father in the morning. A lot of reasoning going on there, if you will. So here you are, and you're learning about you, the individual you, because that's how he intended it. He would come and talk to Adam in the cool of the day. He had his appointment, and he wanted to. And that question that he asked Adam is still out there to every individual. Are you? So as you are walking and beginning to learn about you, as you are now seeing your family outside, some of the core things, the pain and all those different things, you're going to have to, is a kind of a rebirthing of yourself and your relationship and so forth. One of those things that we have to eventually start doing within the journey is a beautiful, painful thing called boundaries, setting boundaries. Mm-hmm. Now, how did you begin to, you are seeing it and you're learning it, you're going to have to learn it, set it with everyone, with yourself, family, husband, child. How did you manage the setting of boundaries once you began to see it? Because it's very important. It's necessary. How did you that area of your life dealing with others as you begin to learn more about you?
The best way I can describe it is kind of like I have a house and then I have a yard, and my yard is on a road, and I planted some forsythia bushes too close. And so people walk inside those forsythia bushes if they're going to walk on my road, because we don't have a sidewalk. Boundaries are something that I think many people are taught. Boundaries are something we set out here for mm-hmm. other people. The reality is, for me, and the way I teach it, is that boundaries are set inside. I live in my house. My door doesn't stay locked, but a lot of times it is. I live on a pretty safe street. And when I see people walking on my yard, I know, like, oh, he missed the school bus, so he's walking to the, you know, or this guy always walks every day. Or if there's someone random that hangs out too long in my yard, I'm gonna pay attention, right? It's like, this is a loose boundary for me. This is something that, these are areas in my life where it's like, you can wander in and out of my boundaries. They're kind of loose, and I'm gonna allow you to do that. I'm gonna listen to you, et cetera. I may have a conversation, you know. But if anyone walks up to my door, if my door is shut, they're going to knock. If they don't, then that's actually really, really bad. But people understand that when the door is shut, they knock. And so I want to set boundaries in my own personal life that people understand as they need to knock to enter there, right? And you don't need to, nobody sees a closed door on a house as a bad thing. They see it as, oh, this is the way a house is supposed to be, right? So what I like to do is I like to try and help set up my boundaries that are internal for myself. And when people start knocking, and instead of seeing them as like stepping on my boundaries, I just say, oh, they're knocking. Don't let them in. No, I don't. Okay. So I'm going to keep that door shut. Yeah. And if I do want to let them in, if it's a safe way person to let in, then I opened up the door and I let them in. And when I started seeing boundaries that way, based on who I am as a person, based on what I call my core values of the freedom of thought, being authentic and belonging, when wisdom takes precedence over and belonging and wisdom take precedence over ideas and principles, then I can set boundaries that are comfortable for me to protect, and I don't need to defend them with the sword. You know, I don't need to go out and talk to people about, you're stepping on my boundaries. This is a boundary you can't cross. I mean, every once in a while, we're going to meet somebody like that, but I am very interested in living in a gracious way that respects other people as well. And if I model how this is a boundary you're not going to cross for me, sometimes it's silent, sometimes it's not. But I can graciously say, I'm not opening that door to you. I had to say to my family, this is actually to a family member, this is a conversation I'm not interested in having right now. Oh, okay. And that's all. And it was done. And I was honored and they were honored. And I didn't have to tell them that I thought they were quacky. I didn't have to tell them that I thought they were totally wrong. I just was able to say, I'm not interested in having this conversation right now. I think when we are willing to set boundaries based on what our core values are, then it enables us to do that in a way that is very gracious, that is very open to conversation. And it means that we can have several layers, like concentric circles of boundaries,
yes.
But they're all inside, Ken. None of them are out there. I mean, yeah, I have space boundaries. Yeah. Every once in a while, I'll be like, you are a little in my space. But most of the time, it is emotional and internal boundaries. And for someone who really felt like I couldn't think for myself, and I didn't trust myself, and I didn't trust the thoughts that I had that were good and right and true or wise, you know, now I can look at myself and say, you know what? You get to figure this out all on your own without checking with anybody else. That's a boundary that you're going to draw. And then when you're done, if you want to check with people or see what everybody else has to say, that's fine, but you've already made your decision.
Yeah.
And it's okay if it's wrong. And so sometimes our boundaries are for ourselves, but that's the way I view boundaries. I think it's really important to make sure that they're internal rather than external.
Called to live. That's who we are. The body is the house. And so we are designed to make decisions from inside out. Wisdom and all those things are part of that inner individual that we have. You see this mind, and I tell people, I use the story of with the issue of blood to demonstrate the power that the decision maker is inside of that individual. So those who have ears, let them hear. Here on my body, I listen. I hear with my heart. Mm-hmm. Inner individual, that's my soul. Mm-hmm. So this woman heard that Jesus Christ is a healer, and she, and the scripture says, she said within herself.
Right.
Beautiful little, she said within herself. She said in her soul, I could touch, that was an internal decision. If I could touch the hem of his garment, internal decision now will propel the individual to complete what they just said. Mm. That's what you and I have to learn to do. That's when we separate ourselves, you go quiet, because you're getting in touch with yourself so that you can make the decision. You learn your boundaries. You learn all of those things from the, even from the inside out. And that's how we're called to live. Remember that, and you'll your journey will be even more enlightened, if you will. You'll get some insights, if you will. So here you are, being a pastor's wife. I'm sure you're going to have a lot of practice on boundaries. That's another thing. One of the final stages in the development. This is one of the final, it's continuous. Final is continuous. It's surrendering. How did you surrender to you? You surrender all the noises that were telling you how you ought to be. And you said no. How did you make that transition to the surrender aspect of your life? Because as I said, it's that piece right there is a continuous piece. You, as you are being brought more stuff about you, you have to learn how to surrender to those each thing. But you have to have the genesis of it that will continue to move you through. What's yours like, Andrew? I know Jesus was, he sweat blood. He had to surrender. Was yours like?
It wasn't quite sweating blood, but it was about a, but honestly, it was about a 2-year deconstruction of the rules and the institutions and the structure of where I had put my faith. And to understand that my faith and who I am as a person and being designed and the relationship that I have with Jesus is very different from the outward expression that we see a lot of times in especially the American evangelical church. Being willing to walk away from the things that I was, because I was bought into all of it, Ken. I said I was in the music industries. My sister even laughs because she wasn't even in that. She's like, how did you get into all this stuff? I was like, why are you having to deal with all of this? And I'm like, you know, there's a beauty in not being in ministry and not having that, because then you don't have these trappings that you pick up. It's like picking up putting a stone, as my friend says, in a backpack. It's like my backpack was so full, it was all the way down to the floor. And it was just, I was dragging stones along with me and just about one by one taking them out and saying, oh, well, that's patriarchy. And oh, well, this is women's oppression. And oh, well, this has nothing to do with the Bible. And oh, this is selfishness. And oh, this is capitalism. And oh, this is colonialism. And oh, this is blah, 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 blah. You name it. Yeah. And being able to just drop all those and put them down and see the rock pile. But there was a minimum of a year in there where I struggled so desperately. I cried on the floor. I would vomit. It was just hard. Because if this piece, you know, if you've got this elaborate system, if this piece isn't right, how do we not know this piece isn't right?
What
and
else?
This piece and this piece. And if this person turned out to be this terrible person, if you've paid any attention to Southern Baptist news in the last 4 years, if this person turned out to be a terrible person and I supported them and I actually did this stuff, what does that make me? Number one, number two, how blind was I? Number two, if what about them? Well, what about this person and this person and this person? Can I trust anybody? Can I trust any institution? And you have to, I had to be willing to walk through that. That was, you know, I'm not going to compare myself to Jesus, but if anybody sweated blood over it, it would, you know, that's the kind of agony that, you know, I thought my family would disown me. I thought everything would, I thought my husband was, you know, my husband was like, you're a pastor's wife. Are you sure? What are you okay? But at the same time, he just stood there and just loved me through the whole thing. And that's when about halfway through, my sister said, are you okay? Because there are people in our family who think you're losing your religion. And I'm like, I'm not. And I'm not okay. And I'm not losing my religion.
Yeah.
Shedding the things I don't need in order to walk. Like Paul even says, throw off everything that encumbers you so that you can run the race with pride and with beauty and unencumbered and for the glory of God. So I even went through a period of time that I didn't even talk about my faith at all in my business because I was just so careful. And I was so afraid of what I was like, where am I going to land with all this? And so being willing to say, okay, Jesus was about the people and he was about the relationships and he was about peace and not empire. When I now walk into a situation, my goal is to walk in with humility and warmth and grief over whatever trauma is there. When I do that, it opens the door for other people to like, it makes it a safe place for my boundaries to be open, right? Because then I choose for my boundaries to be open, for people to come in and be welcoming. And yes, it is a very, very hard place and it's not over. And as soon as you do one piece, you realize there's other pieces, you know, and it's like, oh, all the politics involved in that. Oh my gosh. Happiness. And you can dump it all off at once. I mean, if you have a pack of rocks on your back and you just dump it all off at once, you're going to fall on your face. It might be worth it. But still, that's just, I guess that's how I would say that was my biggest thing. I used to think it was when my mother died and it was this crucible, but that was nothing. Yeah. I don't want to say that was nothing, but this was bigger. And I think that started the process of getting me to this place.
That's the place we were all called to be. I think what we did is that we created a religion, and Jesus Christ didn't come to create a religion. He did not speak about that. He talked about a personal relationship with his He talked about a personal relationship with his Father. He talked about a personal relationship with him. He talked about, I give you peace. I am the representation of the Father. I do what I see he do. I say, I talk, I speak. So when we move from one kingdom into the other, that's where we're in. We're in a kingdom, and he is the head, and so forth. And we have a religion of Jesus, and he's not about a religion. I think we have to go back to the core, because he said that the assignment that the church has, and we have missed it, and that's why we see the mess it is. The assignment was to make disciples. Assignment was to preach the gospel of the kingdom. We are not preaching the gospel of the kingdom because we have to make people aware of the new policies and procedures that are governing this kingdom that we have come into. It is one of the most powerful ways by which we ought to govern behavior. On this side, it's fear. On this side, he talks about hate. On this side, talks about empathy, your enemies, side, kill them, side. You know, so you have these, and what the religion of Christianity has done, aligned itself with the principles of the old kingdom. That's not what Jesus is. He didn't come to make a, you call it the, I call it the business of religion. Mm. And Jesus went to a temple and dealt with the business of religion by beating a whole bunch of people, kicking down all kinds of stuff. So we do the same, and all those things that we have created, the business of religion, he fought, and it was not him. Mm-hmm. Remember, if you guys listen to Andrew and I, Jesus died today in the holies of holies. There is a separation; only the priest can enter in, and that cloth was rent in half from the top to the bottom. It could only be done by God himself. And he did that. He opened everything so that you and I can have a relationship. He was having a relationship with Adam. It wasn't a religion. We forget that. That's when all hell breaks loose and we prostitute the kingdom and we create a religion. It said, preach the gospel of the kingdom. When you do that, after you have done that, then I'll come. So just a little nugget for you guys, because I get passionate about some of the craziness that we are seeing, and Andrew also seeing as men behave, because those men and women are reverting to, they're not saving their soul by the word of God. Vacated the word. He says, I hid your word in my soul, that I may not sin against you. The boys are not hiding. that's just another story, Andrew. We got to come back for another podcast. You could get me all riled up here. So, but all you guys that have been listening to us, we've had this deep conversation. Andrew has opened herself and allow us to see who she is, how she was given birth, the greatness that is before us. I am so honored that she's here and she shared herself with us. I speak to the listeners and I always say to the listeners to transition from a listener to a hearer. A hearer becomes powerful, become motivated. They become the change that they are seeking. I invite you to become you start as a listener, but switch over. When it says that when you hear, your faith is present when you hear. That faith is your believing for. You're believing about learning about who you are. That's faith. It's just whatever you believe in. When you hear, is present, and you'll be able to move forward in your journey. If you're listening, not there yet. So we want to invite you guys to become hearers. Been spending her time here, and she has a tremendous work that she's doing. And I invite all you women to get in touch. I'm going to provide everything for you guys to reach Andrea or to sit down in her space. I know that we haven't even touched the surface yet. You can tell from our conversation, just playing on the top of the water, as they say. We're in the shallow parts. And you guys give her a call, get in touch with her, and get into the deep spaces so that she can show you and guide you as to who you truly are and the greatness that is designed in you, that you were put together. You're an assignment, working and jobbing, and come into Andrew's space and learn who you are, your assignment about you. One of your assignment is to learn who you are. Mm-hmm. And that's the very first one. And then you'll learn about the works and the other stuff. But your assignment is to learn who you are. Stop jobbing. Get into Andrea's space. Andrea, I know we haven't even touched anything yet. But I want to thank you so much for coming. I'm going to invite you. We're going to continue this conversation. I'm going to invite you so that we can get into the nitty-gritty of it, girl, the hands-on stuff, so we can get a little dirty, as they say, and bring the people deeper into your world so that they can see what they receive once they have made that phone call and how they get into the deepness of themselves. And so I want to thank you so much for coming and introducing you to us here at Threads of Enlightenment.
Thank you. It has been my honor.
Thank you. It wasn't that bad. I didn't beat you up that bad.
No, not at all.
I love your testimony.
Oh, thank you.
Powerful one. You know, and thank I want to bring you back to go into that because I think it's necessary.